Northwestern Medicine, relentless in their pursuit of better health care. Learn more at nm.org/better.
It is time to talk some medical news. We welcome back to the program this week Dr. Jeremy Silver, who is the medical director of emergency medicine, Northwestern's Kishwaukee Hospital in DeKalb. Dr. Silver, welcome back. Very nice to have you back on the show with us this week.
Good to be back, Dean. Thanks for having me.
We had such a nice reaction to you being on with us last week. So many people called in, texted, emailed how much they enjoyed your visit on the show. So we're happy that you could join us again. And we wanted to focus this week a little bit on heart health. February is National Heart Month. Is heart disease still the number one killer in America?
It is. It's the leading cause of death for men, women, adults, of course, and most people of most racial and ethnic groups in the U.S. Every 33 seconds, someone dies from cardiovascular disease or heart disease. And every year, somewhere around 700,000 people die from heart disease. That's like the population of Boston just erasing from the map. So it's a significant issue. And it's also a significant financial cost is associated with this hundreds of billions of dollars every year dedicated to the cost of the illness. So it's a lot of opportunity here to make a difference and something that's pretty important.
Are men more susceptible to heart disease than women?
Men and women are equally susceptible. I think, you know, In the prior iteration of medicine, let's say in the 20th century, classically we thought that men were kind of special in this regard. But we're learning more and more about women. We actually miss, unfortunately, we miss a significant amount of illness in women because of that kind of inherent bias. But I'm not aware of evidence to suggest that men are more susceptible. There's certain different risk factors for different groups. And so I think it's important that we all stay apprised of the knowledge and education that's out there and that people understand that it can happen to any of us.
Yeah. So everybody listen up while we talk about this a little bit. You talked about the risk factors. What are the biggest risk factors for men and women?
Well, I think, you know, none of us can escape our genes. So my father, who's was a former emergency medicine physician, used to say you can never escape the genetic vortex. And so I kind of laugh about that, but it's very true. So I think genes play an incredibly important role. But so does lifestyle. And so things like smoking, and as we're learning more about alcohol, that could play a significant role. But also diet is hugely important. And then other diseases of the cardiovascular system, such as high blood pressure, diabetes, kidney disease, all of these medical problems kind of play into heart health. They're all tied together, because the heart is tied to all of those organs through the vascular system or through the arteries. So there's a variety of modifiable risk factors, and then there are some areas that it's harder to have an impact on in terms of your genetics.
Yeah, they're just that's what you're born with. So you know take care of what you can take care of. You know, the genetics you deal with as best that you can. So where do we start with this? I mean, is diet, you think, the biggest impact on this, people being overweight?
Well, certainly having obesity raises the risk for disease of the heart. And being sedentary is actually significantly important and may actually in the long run be more important than having a few extra pounds. But simply sitting at your desk, we know that folks that sit for a living have a higher risk. So if you sit at your desk all day long versus somebody who's active, say somebody who's walking around for their job, you're automatically at a higher risk for this disease. So absolutely, lifestyle plays a huge part. Diet is also a very important piece of this. And so diets that are heavy in saturated fats, certainly we know that red meat, when eaten in excess, raises the risk of heart disease. Processed foods, fast food, for instance, or food that you microwave out of a box that you get frozen in the supermarket aisle, those foods tend to raise inflammation in the body and tend to increase the risk of disease to the arteries of the body and the heart. So we try to emphasize the importance of cooking your own meals, eating a diet that's rich in fruit, vegetables, and nuts. And if you're going to eat meat, which is perfectly fine, try to make most of the meat you eat lean meat, white meat like poultry or pork or certainly fish.
Okay. Now, you talk about a sedentary lifestyle and trying to be active. Do you buy into the you must do X number of steps per day? That seems to be super popular where people's phones or their watches or, you know, some kind of pedometer is measuring the number of steps people take per day. Is that a good way of measuring how active you should be, or do you like something else?
I think it's great to quantify and set goals. And if having a pedometer or a smartwatch or device to kind of help you keep track of that, it helps get you out of the house or up and around, then I think that's wonderful. I don't know that the data is points to any one particular number, number of steps or number of minutes per day or amount of output. I just think it, in general, my reading of the literature is the more you can be active, and certainly walking every day is a great accessible means of being active. Everybody can walk if you're able to use your legs, and that's a great place to start. So I don't tell my patients any particular number. I just try to encourage more is better.
About how much physical activity per day, and I'm talking about just, walking. Is the point to raise the heartbeat level to a certain point? Is that what you're trying to accomplish with the increased physical activity?
Sure. So aerobic activity where your heart rate is increased, and you're moving those oxygen molecules around the body, we know that improves heart health. I think if we started with a number of 30 minutes per day, that's probably a good place to start at. But even 15 or 20 minutes of activity where your heart rate is increased and maybe you're starting to get little beads of sweat on your forehead, maybe your respiratory rate is up a little bit. Even just 15 minutes of aerobic activity is found to be effective. 30 minutes of walking or 15 minutes of aerobic activity, I think is reasonable.
Yeah, that's what my doctor has told me. I told my doctor, excuse me, I'm busy. I don't have time. And, the doctor said to me is you have to find 15 to 30 minutes just to do it. You don't have 15 minutes in a day to go and do this someplace, ultimately has said you can't afford to not do this. You are at that age where you really need to do it. So it's something that I think a lot of us need to take a lot more seriously.
I agree with you, Dean, and I agree with your position. I think in the medical field, we like to think about this as an investment in your future. So the same way that you put money in the stock market and watch it grow over time, and the stock market goes up and down, and so do our exercise patterns. In around the holidays, we tend to be spending time with family and maybe pushing the sweets and things of that nature. And then January rolls around and we recommit ourselves. And that variation is totally normal. It's part of the human experience. But overall, making a commitment to invest in yourself is going to pay dividends, whether it's quickly jumping on the exercise bike for 5 minutes or doing some yoga or grabbing a neighbor or your partner and taking a walk. Whatever that means to you, anything is better than nothing.
Yep, that's exactly. You may as well have taken the words right out of my physician's mouth. I think all you people must talk to each other.
We called each other before I called in today.
Yes, apparently. Apparently, I'm feeling very guilty right now. What about all these weight loss medicines that are out there now, these injectables that people are taking, the Ozempics and Mounjaros, and I forget the name of them all. Seems to be doing a fairly good job with weight loss. Are you a fan of those?
Well, I think you have to be careful about jumping on the bandwagon with new medicine. I will say that the data out of the trials that led to these drugs kind of coming into popular culture looks really, really good, particularly for people with diabetes. These drugs are going to be life-saving for that segment of the population. I don't think there's any question about that. But when it comes to folks that are using the drugs simply for weight loss, I'm not sure that the jury's out yet on what the potential other side effects may be. So there's very obvious physical changes, and some of those are quite pleasing to folks. You lose kind of that double chin that you're trying to get rid of, or maybe a little bit of girth around the waist. And that feels good when you look in the mirror and you see a healthier looking person looking back at you. There's nothing wrong with feeling good about that. But these drugs do carry with them some side effects, and a lot of GI side effects, meaning the side effects of the gut, so the cramping, abdominal pain, gas, et cetera. But I also think, you know, down the line, 5-10 years from now, we'll have a better sense of kind of what the overall impact is going to be. So I would just say, you know, I think cautiously optimistic, but also tincture of time will tell us more.
Yeah. What about, I want to open up the phone line and the text line for Dr. Jeremy Silver. If you have questions, if you have comments, 312-981-7200 to get some of your medical questions answered. But I wanted to talk a little bit more, go back to American Heart Month, and talk about some of the testing that people have available to them to see what shape their heart is in right now. I've always, you know, heard about stress tests, and you get on the treadmill and you're all wired up, and you know, you go through all of that stuff. I've done that several times. Is that still the best and greatest way of measuring your heart health?
Sure. I think just to take a step back, Dean, and say, you know, just to remind folks that the heart is the pump that pumps blood around the body, and that blood, the whole reason for being of blood is that it carries oxygen that you breathe into all the organs in your body and helps them function. And so when that pump becomes dysfunctional, then your oxygen delivery becomes dysfunctional, and all of your organs can suffer. So it's absolutely critical to whole body health and longevity that the heart is able to function. And so there's a variety of ways of looking at that function, one of which is certainly symptoms. So if you're doing your daily jog and you're having chest pain, that would be a red flag that you need to go and get looked at. And so I would start with the most basic of tests, and how do you feel? On the other hand, if you get on your bike and you go for a 40-mile bike ride and come home and feel great, that's a great stress test right there. So I think starting with the most basic of things is how do you feel when you're active? And if you're feeling lousy when you're active, then please see your provider, your physician or nurse practitioner. In terms of the tests that we can provide, there's a variety of different tests. As you mentioned, the walking treadmill test. For folks that can't do that, maybe they have bad knees or hips, or for some other reason are able to tolerate that, there's nuclear imaging that we do where the person can sit and a drug is injected into the bloodstream that mimics activity and gets the heart rate pumping, and then pictures are taken of the heart, and you can see if areas of the heart aren't functioning normally in that regard. There's a variety of other tests that are now available. There's something called a coronary calcium score, which is a CT scan. So the heart is essentially, you take pictures of the heart and look at the coronary arteries and measure radiologists measure the calcium deposits, and they can sort of generate a risk score based on that. And certainly other tests such as cardiac MRI are available for certain types of conditions. So there's truly a wide array of tests, different tests for different folks, depending on what the cardiologist thinks would be most appropriate.
708 area code says my family is loaded with a history of heart bypasses and widow makers. How hereditary is heart disease?
Extremely. I'm glad that person reached out. My first response would be that I hope that you have a primary care physician that you've spoken about this with. And if you don't have one, I would encourage you to reach out and try and identify one if you have health insurance or your health insurance plan. But it is hereditary. And when you hear that, that perks my ears up as an ER doctor. If that person came in to see me in the emergency room, I'd immediately ratchet up their risk in the back of my mind to a much higher level. That being said, that's only one part of the picture, so you have to gather more data. But it definitely plays a huge, huge role.
In talking about the widowmaker, are those, I guess you might say, congenital conditions of the heart that you were talking about before, things which are you're just born with, a certain condition of the heart, and maybe the history of your family's heart health. Those are things that are, are the way that they are, and you just have to kind of keep an eye on them. These conditions where you could have a heart attack that would kill you instantly.
Yeah, so the widow maker or the widower maker is they're referring to a heart attack that is lethal, where the main artery of the heart fills with plaque, becomes inflamed. Plaque would be kind of fatty deposits, cholesterol deposits building up and becoming hardened, and over time blocking the flow of blood and leading to what we call a heart attack, that being the death of heart muscle due to lack of blood flow to that area. That left anterior descending artery, or the quote-unquote widowmaker artery, that supplies significant flow of blood to that chamber of the heart that does a majority of the pumping, the left ventricle. That's the part of the heart, the part of the heart muscle that pumps out blood to the rest of the body. So certainly that's a concerning history and something we all want to avoid. That being said, there are lots of new drugs available and advances in drug manufacturing that are coming out every day, it seems, that are going to help those folks reduce their risk. So it's not the end of the world. It's certainly not a guaranteed outcome, that being the widowmaker. But I think I would want to pursue those therapies if that were my family.
Yeah, 630 area code writes on a text, I sometimes feel like my heart is skipping a beat, and at other times the beat of my heart goes very, very quickly. Is this dangerous?
It certainly can be. That would fall into the category of a problem with the electrical system of the heart. So as we mentioned before, the heart's a pump, and the heart is a four-chambered muscle, essentially. It's a highly specialized muscle, unlike any other in the body, and it's susceptible to hormones and can actually remodel itself under certain conditions, so it's quite a unique structure. But it also has an electrical system that enables the heart muscle cells to contract in synchronicity. It's really a miracle of the human body. And so sometimes that electrical system either can become damaged over time as we age, or there are certain anomalies genetically that predispose certain folks to, as this person mentioned, skip beats or extra beats or fast beats. And many of those, what we call arrhythmias, meaning an abnormal rhythm of the heart, are totally benign. They're not harmful. They're annoying and disconcerting. It doesn't feel good to have that normal rhythm disrupted. But what I will say is that that can't be diagnosed over the phone, unfortunately. I would strongly encourage that individual to see their doctor if they felt it was important to get a referral to a cardiologist. And certainly, if it becomes a problem, we're happy to see that individual in the emergency room.
Of course. Is this a condition under which someone might be a candidate for a pacemaker to regulate the beat of their heart?
Sure. Good question. So these arrhythmias, again, the rhythm of the heart is typically a lub-dub, 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 a very stable, consistent, steady rhythm. But for some folks, that becomes disrupted. It can become irregular, or it can become too fast, or it can be too slow, or sometimes both fast and then slow. So there's a variety of permutations. It's not just kind of one condition, but many. And so if there is a problem, either with the heart, generally with the heart beating too slow, then yes, pacemaker can absolutely fix that. And sometimes in folks where the rhythm becomes too fast or too irregular, cardiologists will actually go in and zap that area that's the culprit, and then just completely make the person pacemaker dependent, and that fixes the problem. So there's a lot of different solutions depending on what the issue may be for that individual.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, the technology is absolutely amazing. At age 94, my mom had a heart valve replacement. And if anyone prior to that would have told me that heart valve surgery on a 94-year-old woman would have been appropriate, I would have said that they're nuts. But it was amazing. It was amazing how it corrected so many of the problems that she had. So bottom line is, check with your own physicians on this. This is a good month to do it, National Heart Month. Dr. Jeremy Silver, it's a pleasure to have you back on the show today, the medical director of emergency medicine, Northwestern's Kishwaukee Hospital in DeKalb. Doctor, I hope you have a great Sunday today. Thank you so much.